We have special news for you.
The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
Are you going to send me or anybody that I know to a camp?
We have people that are stupid.
I, Donald John Trump, do solemnly swear.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
Special inaugural edition. The Ricochet Podcast meets Need to Know. Jane Nordlinger, Mona Charon, Peter Robinson. Let's have ourselves a podcast.
Bye-bye.
Welcome, everybody, to this, the Ricochet Podcast, number 337, with an extra added bonus, as we'll tell you in a second. We're brought to you by The Great Courses. You know, it's the start of the year. January is like a clean slate, and we all think about ways we can improve our lives, make the most of our time, like learning new things. Who doesn't want to do that? Ricochet listeners, that would be you. Get a full free month free, a free month full, a full month. Well, you get the idea. Just sign up now. They'll also teach you how to record spots, probably. It's a special URL to start watching, thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we're brought to you by Harry's Shave. For a great shave at an even better price, you simply must go to Harry's. Go to harrys.com/ricochet and enter the code, and you start shaving and saving, and your face will love you for it. And we're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100 job sites, 100 plus. That's including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. And, of course, we're brought to you by Ricochet, this thing that you perhaps stumbled into wondering what it is. Well, it's the place on the Internet for civil center-right conversation. If you're joining us from the Slate Panoply Network, perhaps you're on the other side of the aisle and you'd like to know what your adversaries intellectually think. This is the place to find out. Be one of the 1,500. We're more than halfway there to the new member goal, and you can help us out. Now, a Ricochet gift certificate is just the best gift you can give everybody. I know the gift-giving season is past, but Valentine is coming up. And show your love for somebody's mind by getting them a membership to Ricochet. And while you're at it, you might want to just subscribe to the Daily Shot. That's Ricochet's free daily email newsletter. It's a great way to keep tabs on current events and see what's going on the center-right side of the aisle and do so with an amusing tone as well. And barring that, at least you get a couple of laughs out of it. Well, I'm James Lilacs. Peter Robinson is here. Hello, Peter.
Hello, James.
And we have, because we have partnered up, as they say, in a synergistic melding with Need to Know, which means that Jay Nordlinger and Mona Charon are with us. So we have pretty much a spectrum of people on the Trump side. We've got Peter who voted. We have me who was not I didn't. And we have Mona and Jay who really weren't and didn't. So perhaps we're also going to bring Victor Davis Hanson into the conversation. And he was a Trump supporter from very early on. So no matter where you are in the Trump spectrum, you're going to hear it today. Something to like, something not to like. Jay, though, I have to tell you this. I was listening to the Salem Network coverage of the event. And you know what they used for the music going in and out of commercials? It was this. Recognize?
Sorry, I didn't hear anything, James.
I didn't hear a peep.
Oh,
I
sorry.
I didn't either.
Oh, okay, well, then let me stop that.
Why don't you just sing?
It was The Crown Imperial by Coronation March by William Walton.
Yeah.
I thought it was not a coronation. It was an American transfer of power of the sort that we've seen often, maybe not so much without the black mask guys rampaging through Washington, D.C., throwing things through the windows of McDonald's, but part of a tradition. And the speech was part of a tradition in as much as it said things and promised things. And let's go down the line and ask everybody what they thought. Peter.
No beauty, no elegance. There were some lines in there that he could have delivered that were poetic, but he chose to deliver every single line as if he was throwing a punch. It was raw, but for all that, I thought cogent and powerful. Agree with him or disagree with him, he laid out principles. And to me, the takeaway runs as follows. The principal point of this runs as follows. When George W. Bush gave his second inaugural address, I can't quote it exactly, but the paraphrase is, the United States isn't safe until there are no more tyrannies left in the world. It was a declaration that it was the business of the United States to institute democracies around the world, and we weren't done until democracy had triumphed across the globe. Barack Obama, his first inaugural address was largely devoted, almost you could say, to new modes of being. We were going to be post-partisan. We were going to be post-racial. He was going to lift us and inspire us. There was talk about the economy, of course, because the economy was flat on its back at that point, but also about the environment. And Donald Trump is none of that. It's the line that stood out to me: great schools, safe neighborhoods, good jobs. These are just and reasonable demands. Practical, down to earth, addressed very directly to ordinary Americans and to the concerns of ordinary Americans. America, he repeated it. The one principle we're going to have is America first, and he repeated it: America first. That's now, that opens all kinds of questions. What does that mean for foreign policy? We have carried other countries, and he's quite right. Throughout the post-war, Second World period, we have carried other countries, but we've also argued that it was in our own interest to do so. That's an open question. But the way he is going at policy, the way he is going at the job, is quite starkly different from either George W. Bush or Barack Obama, I thought.
America first, I think, in the future we'll find to be a flexible metric. Jay?
Well, I really don't belong on this show, James, and I didn't want to do it.
All right, thanks for joining us. Mona?
Well, I think you're right. I think you have a point, James, in that and I have a point. It's a Trump's day and the day for Trump Nation. I think it's less a day for the whole nation, as Trump made clear in his address. I was going to give it a rest for a day, but here I am. I thought it was a disgusting speech, absolutely disgusting, demagogic, ungracious, ranty. It really wasn't very different from one of his rally speeches. I didn't think it was an inaugural address. And you could credit him with candor. Before the Republican convention, I had this thought, almost a worry, that Trump wouldn't be himself in his acceptance speech. He would be artful, nuanced, appeasing, calculating. The speech would be written by someone else, by a polished writer, and the speech would be pretty. No, he gave a raw, unvarnished Trump speech. And I kind of admired him for that. There was no dissembling. It was pure, demagogic, populist, Bannon-esque Trump. And lo and behold, he did the same in the inaugural address. Now, I think his view of the country is absolutely screwy, that America is a kind of hellscape. I think he used the phrase American carnage today. His inaugural address, and maybe this is to his credit, was just like his final ad of the campaign, his so-called closing argument, when he said that elites at home and abroad were conspiring to do the little guy down and no more. You know, the people will stand up. One thought that occurred to me was that we on the right, especially in the early Obama years, mocked Obama and his people mercilessly for a year zero mentality. Nothing had ever happened before. With us, everything begins. In this respect, Trump is even worse. I thought it was a nasty inaugural address and borderline un-American for all its talk of America first and patriotism. I thought it was almost a beer hall rant rather than an American inaugural address. But he is the people's choice, at least through the Electoral College. And in a democracy, you get what you vote for and you have another crack at it. His thoughts and his style are not mine, but they are for millions and millions and millions of people, and that's democracy.
So you've softened your opposition since the campaign then,
I'm saying what I think is true.
When you mentioned
being a politician and being a writer and not really caring what the audience thinks. I think a writer or an opinionist owes the public what he thinks. He should get – and this, I'm saying this to myself because I'm a great – punch puller, both in my political writing and my music criticism. I always pull punches. Always, always, always. And I like being liked, as everyone does. But damn it, this is what I think.
And good for you for saying so, but I have to clarify something, or at least explore it a little bit more before we get to Mona. When you said beer hall, of course, you're well aware what the resonance for that is.
Yeah.
People are going to say that some people will hear that and think a Weimar era beer hall putsch. Other people will say, well, maybe if that beer hall is a VFW club in a town in Ohio whose downtown is completely gone, they would say that, that's a beer hall where that's going to resonate. And those are two different places. And while I agree that
let's go with Akron, James.
Okay. I don't like the carnage idea and the dark dystopian America, which some people are finding that to be the heart of the speech. I don't think that's the case. Yes, overstated. Yes, but there are swaths of America out there that heard that and think of their community and find that somebody is speaking for them. I'm not saying I agree with the speech and I'm not defending the speech. I'm just telling you there's an awful lot of people out there who really heard that. And
always tell people like me, you don't get it. And the truth is, sometimes you do get it and don't like it.
You don't like it.
I don't like the stoking of grievances and the whipping up of resentment. And I think this is what Trump does. And I like better a Republican Party of personal accountability and the reform of the addressing of national problems.
Well, one of the people on NPR interviewed afterwards was saying that when Trump
I'm sorry, but could we get to Mona as well? If it's open conversation, Jay has said about half a dozen things with which I not only disagree, but had to mute myself so that I wouldn't deafen Scott Immergood as he edits the show. And so if this is open discussion, I'm going to weigh in and tell Jay I think he's not only wrong, but wildly so. If it's still round robin, let's get to Mona, if you don't mind.
Mona.
All right. My view is that for conservatives who have believed a series of things over the past number of decades, for example, we believe in the power of markets versus the power of government. We believe in American leadership around the world. We're very concerned about threats to liberty and so forth. It has been a bit since the election. It has been we've been experiencing cognitive dissonance because Trump has made a series of appointments that are very pleasing, very, very pleasing. Great conservative picks and about 75% in my judgment. But what we have not known is how much of his administration was going to be traditionally Republican/conservative and guided by those principles and how much of it was going to be populist and Trumpian. And what we saw today, in my judgment, is a strong signal that as much as Republicans may want to kid themselves that what we're going to be getting is conservative governance, on the contrary, we're getting a kind of populism that is not conservative. It may or may not be good for the country, and we can debate that, but it certainly isn't it isn't the kind of philosophy that most people associate with conservatism.
Peter?
Oh, back to me. Okay. We can go around and around in the circle. So I'm a little bit at a loss. Here on the economic side, it seems to me that the speech, you could read all kinds of things into the speech. And I'm grasping, Jay and Mona are grasping, we're all of us trying to figure out what to make of this guy. And I very heavily read this speech through, now as though it sounds as though we're in an English class, but why not, through the interpretive metric of his appointments. So he says, we've carried other countries. That has to stop. And yet his appointment for Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, said during his confirmation hearing that if NATO didn't exist, we would have to create it, that the NATO alliance is absolutely essential. Now, Jim Mattis also said we need to work on the alliance. And the idea that there are 28 member countries and only five of them pay the proportion that they're supposed to pay toward their own defense under the treaty obligations, that is to say 23 countries are engaging in blatant free riding on the United States and our defense establishment, that needs to stop. Well, that seems to me that Jim Mattis is a very serious person that's consonant with what Trump is saying. On the economic side, Trump said, let's see, I scribbled a few notes, and I think if this isn't an exact quotation, I've got most of the wording right. Washington flourished, but the people did not share in its wealth. Now, that just seems to me objectively true.
I think that's such a misperception about what the problem is. You know, the problem with Obama was not that he enriched a few people who live inside the zip code or inside the beltway. The problem is that he's a progressive who thinks that a small elite should be making decisions for everybody else. That gave us Obamacare and Dodd-Frank and a lot of other bad policy. But it wasn't just to enrich a few bureaucrats who live in the beltway. That's ridiculous.
Oh, but it's not ridiculous. It did happen. Washington did get richer. The upper income, the richest people in New York did get richer. The middle class did see its income stagnate or even drop some, depending on which measures
that is,
you look
those
at.
Those are trends that are world throughout the developing world, where the post-industrial economy delivers much more return to people with high incomes, to people with lots of education and skills, and relatively lower returns to people without skills. But it really has nothing to do with the critique. And so you'd find that in any city. You'll find it in San Francisco and Austin and anywhere in this country, and in London and in Paris. It seems to me the proper critique mm-hmm. of progressivism is not that, because the proper critique of progressivism is that it does not work to improve the lives of the less fortunate, that it, if anything, cements those differences rather than seeking to in place rather than seeking to overcome them. But it isn't. The way he framed it and the way populists frame it is that, you know, it's these bunch of people who are enriching themselves, like be they bankers or politicians, they're enriching themselves at your expense. Well, not really. I mean, they are. If so, then the only rich people in America, you know, would be Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and Janet Yellen. And of course, that's just a complete misreading of the situation.
Well, he got something right. Washington flourished and the people did not. That is objectively the case. And it's not a disgusting statement. It's not as full or accurate a reading. I mean, I'm with you, of course, Mona, 100% on you can elaborate the errors of progressivism in ways that Donald Trump pretty clearly doesn't even seem to grasp. But this notion, here's another quotation, we are transferring power from Washington, D.C., and giving it back to you, the people. That's pretty close to Ronald Reagan's first inaugural address, in which he said, in the present crisis, government is not the solution. Government is the problem. Pretty close. In other words,
I don't think it's close, but, you know.
Well,
we'll see. No, I think he also pledged in this speech that.
Hold on. Let me finish my thought.
Okay,
go
ahead.
It is close. Power from Washington back to the people. Reagan says government is the problem. We're giving power back to the people. They're not only close, they're virtually identical sentiments. What you're saying is, I think, you don't believe Donald Trump is going to govern the way Ronald Reagan governed. And I'm very likely the case. He will disappoint us in any number of ways. But Jay said this speech was disgusting. I don't think it was disgusting at all. It was imperfect, but it was filled with patriotic impulses. It had some shortcomings, and the one place where, in my judgment, he's just wrong and wrong and wrong again is on trade. But in other areas, there are – what am I trying to say? What I'm trying to say is you take the cabinet he's put in place, you assume goodwill on his part, that he's a patriot without, frankly, much experience of – he hasn't been reading National Review, let alone writing for it for years. He's fumbling his way toward – he understands there's a problem with the country. In other words, if you take a charitable construction of this, this is something conservatives can work with and live with. I think we don't have to be outraged about it. It is still far better than what we would be hearing under Hillary Clinton. And yes, we need to prepare ourselves to disagree with him when he's wrong, which is going to be a lot of the time. But I also think there are going to be places, and particularly again, I come back to this as we all do to these cabinet appointments, where Betsy DeVos at education, good Lord, that's wonderful. Okay.
It is.
Okay. I'm saying, taking a charitable view of this, as I think today we probably ought to do, there's stuff we can work with here, and it's certainly here, not.
Here's my problem, Peter. I think I was asked to critique the speech. Maybe I'm wrong. And you're talking about the cabinet and Betsy DeVos and working together and all that. I could talk about that stuff too.
I'm talking about reading the speech through the interpretive clues we've gotten by way of the cabinet, because the speech could be interpreted many ways.
Well, it's something into which people will read what they want to read oftentimes. After the speech, as I was saying, listening to NPR, a reporter was mentioning the line about how things will be seen through the prism as to whether or not they are good for America, America first. And she said, well, that, you know, that sounds good if you're someone in the heartland, but somebody in Germany may look at that and wonder how that's going to. And I thought that's an interesting distinction, that the heartland. I would think that that's not necessarily a sentiment that is confined to that. But if you live in D.C., perhaps, it is entirely possible to see yourself more as an instrument and a member of a larger initiative, shall we say, that takes the entire world into consideration and looks down a little bit on those provincial hicks in the heartland with their little local biases. But
you're running for office, James?
No, not at all. If I was, I'd pick Betsy DeVos, because I, like we all say, this is the sort of paradigm shattering stuff that we love. And the more that you hear the left get incensed over the idea of breaking up the public school monopoly, the happier you are. And I can't. And again, I can't listen to the speech without thinking, who is this going to make mad that I want to be mad and unhappy about this? And education is one of them. But education just isn't limited to what the public schools can do for you. It's what you can do for yourself in your private home. And that's where the great courses comes in. As we said before, it is so satisfying to learn something new, whether it's a topic you already like or something that you just like to learn more about. And that's why we're happy to give you the opportunity to take a Great Courses Plus course. They're offering you, our listeners, a full free month when you sign up using this specific URL. That would be thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. How many lectures? Oh, about 8,000 or so. And they're adding new ones all the time, so chances are you get through all of them in 1 month? No, that's why you want to stick around for a few more. Explore the topics that interest you and discover other stuff like history, politics, business, cooking, philosophy, photography, and they're all presented by award-winning experts. Like the one we recently watched, Outsmart Yourself, Brain-Based Strategies to a Better You. Now, 80-95% of the people report that they procrastinate once they get around to answering the survey, and 50% say it's a problem in their lives. Well, you can learn evidence-based strategies, that's right, science, on how to outsmart your brain to reduce procrastination, and also learn how to eliminate fears and boost your creativity and even slow down the decline of the brain as you age. Not happening here, but it could happen to you. So why don't you go straight to thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet to get that first month free. Remember, if you want that free month, greatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/ricochet. And we thank them, of course, for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Now let's hear from somebody who is steeped in classical rhetoric going back, 2,000-3,000 years. That would be Victor Davis Hanson. He's the Martin and Anderson Senior Fellow at Residence in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institution, Stanford University, Professor of Classics Emeritus at California State University, Fresno, and a nationally syndicated columnist for Tribune Media Services. Of course, you can listen to his classicist podcast right here on Ricochet, and we welcome him back to the podcast. Welcome, Victor. You're walking into a bloodbath here. Jay Nordlinger just accused me of wanting to be a politician or running for office or something, so all civility is broken down completely. listen, you became a Trump supporter during the primaries, and you're one of those people that we want to go to when we ask, what is Trumpism? The problem that some people have is that to say that there is such a thing is to read into the man things that necessarily are not there but that we would like to be. So I'll ask you exactly, what is Trumpism, and how'd you like the speech?
Well, there's two things, Trumpism, the man and the style, and Trumpism, the agenda. And they're both, as you say, they're hard to decipher because there's no manifesto, there's no Trump down ballot movement, there's no Ross Perot third party. The agenda is pretty clear that if you can deregulate, simplify taxes, go full blast on energy exploration and exportation, and get interest rates moderate rather than zero and cut federal spending, you're supposedly going to unleash this Reagan-esque pent-up power. And unlike Reagan, he has both houses of Congress, and he's got the legislatures and the governorships. And he's been weaponized by Obama and Harry Reid. So he's probably going to enact it. And then we'll see whether the great conservative libertarian dream is real or false. And that means if he gets if he gets Reagan 7.6 economic growth, then Trumpism says all these inner city problems, everything can be cured by business, by profit, by prosperity. And everything else will pale in comparison. And then on foreign policy, I don't think it's isolation. It's, as Charles Krauthammer just alleges, Lindbergian, but hyper-nationalist. And I could go on, but I think he's a moralist in the sense of being a deist, that he thinks morality in the Frank Capra sense is updated for race, class, and gender, is great for 21st century America, even though he himself could never meet the standards he would want other people to apply to and aspire to.
It was sort of a rough inauguration for atheists with six different prayers and Donald Trump referring to God. Victor, it's Peter here. Hello.
Yeah, and I think finally, Peter, Trumpism is a style, and I did actually read Think Big, Art of the Deal, Comeback, those three books on Kindle, and then I kind of collated them with his speeches. I've been watching them, and there's three things that is Trumpism, and one is feigned craziness or obstreperousness or craziness, yeah. And that is of value when you deal or you negotiate with an opponent. You never attack a person. You never attack John McCain, initiated it. You never initiated John Lewis. You never initiated Meryl Streep. You never initiated any of these.
How did John McCain initiate it?
What?
How did John McCain initiate a quarrel with Trump?
Well, he said Trump was completely unfit for the Republican Party. He started it. That's what got Trump to reply back to him. He said, John McCain has said this about you. And he said, well, you know, he channeled George Papp. I'm not defending him. I'm just saying there's a pattern there that he believes that once he's attacked, then he goes crazy and hits back twice as hard. And then the third trait, besides being reactive in a very crude fashion and acting crazy, is that he feels as a real estate dealmaker in Manhattan that you demand triple of what you would eventually settle for as an acceptable, profitable deal. And that's part of the... So when he says NATO is obsolete and NATO is questionable and NATO doesn't fight terrorism, what he's saying is that if the Secretary General and the countries will up their contributions by 5%, that would be a victory. Or he's saying, I'm going to pull everybody back. At times he said that. And I think what he means is if you build a fence, you have E-Verify, and you deport people to criminal record, that is real progress. And then you give a green card to the people who are able-bodied and working and haven't committed a crime and have been here, say, 3 to 5 years.
Victor, that's Peter here. Victor, okay. Jay loathed the speech. Jay will tell you in his own words, but very briefly, Jay called the speech disgusting, thought it appealed to our worst impulses. Mona said it misdiagnosed the real problems. I thought it ranged from okay to pretty good. And so my view is uninteresting. I'm going to drop out. But what did you think of the speech? And I then turn you over to the untender hands of Mona Charon and Jay Nordlinger on the speech. What did you think of it?
I don't know. Well, it was short, and I like short speeches. And he's made the devil's bargain with his supporters. And you can't tell the irredeemables and the deplorables and the clingers for 2 years that you're going to fight Washington and then go in there and be sober and judicious. So it was unlike any speech we've ever seen. It was pretty tough. It basically said the world was pretty bad for the middle classes. And I think the criticism of it was probably that the world is not that bad compared to Oaxaca, Mexico or something. But I tell you, living here, and I'm looking out the window at Selma, where it's 16% unemployment and the per capita income is 1/10 of Menlo Park, I think it is pretty bad. And when I go into that town, I see things that my grandparents would have never dreamed of. And I've been all through rural California, rural Michigan. When you go into the Walmart in Jonesville, Michigan, it's pretty scary. And so that's what he's talking about. And so it doesn't, I mean, statistically, yeah, we're in the 21st century. We've got iPhones. But I just got back yesterday from Oakland speaking. And believe me, I had to go down and get lost some things. I had to go down to a market at 10 o'clock at night. That's not okay. It's not. It's just a place you don't go to, period. And then I drove home yesterday on the California freeway system in the rain, and I saw things that are, you know, that are pretty scary. So his gloomy view can be, it's not what's on the coast. It's not what the Facebook people think of. It's not Wall Street. It's not New York. But in between, there's areas that are pretty frightening. I think they're frightening. And I can see why he's saying that, even though it's exaggerated and hyperbolic.
Can we go back to what Trumpism is or isn't? I'll stipulate that we don't really know, that there have been a lot of signals in all kinds of directions, and we're all waiting to see what really transpires. Obviously, the best possible scenario would be the one, something similar to what you outlined, Victor, that he's throwing out negotiating positions and he'll, you know, that this is all sort of a part of a strategy. There's a darker interpretation as well. But let me just point out the one part that I think you left out that I think is a constitutive part of the Trump vision of the world. And I think it has been consistent throughout his career. And I find it disturbing slash very worrying. And that is, he has always believed that trade is a zero-sum game at which we are losing, that we are being taken advantage of by our trading partners, that we are giving away, he said it today in his inaugural address, giving away our industry to other nations. And if you look at the three appointees that he has made on the subject of trade, so, as I mentioned before, some of his nominees have been terrific. But on this subject that I think he cares passionately about and really deeply believes in, protectionism, he has named Wilbur Ross, who's a protectionist, Robert Lighthizer, ditto, and Peter Navarro, who some people think is off the charts, who thinks of trade as a matter of warfare.
Lighthizer and Navarro to which positions, Mona? Just to,
he is Navarro is going to be Wilbur Ross for commerce, Lighthizer for USTR, and Navarro to head something called the National Trade Council, which is a new creation.
Okay,
and so those are.
I wouldn't want to be a Bill Clinton relativist, but it does depend on how we define fair, free, and protectionism. Because I'll give you an example. Ronald Reagan was a free trader, and when I was farming, the EU slapped a $400 ton subsidy on Greek raisins, which destroyed the California market because we couldn't produce it. Reagan's envoy came out, said, "Hey, you guys, you're going to have to make up that $400. You know what? You're going to be leaner and meaner and tougher, and eventually they'll go broke." And it happened 30 years post facto, but it destroyed everything I grew up with. So when I get up in the morning, somebody doesn't call me and say, "Hey, Victor, your column is outsourced to somebody for South Korea for 10 cents a word." This doesn't happen. Somebody at Hoover doesn't say, "You know, we decided to downsize because we've outsourced the Hoover Institution to Mexico." But everybody I grew up with, it does happen. It's a fact of life. So you don't want protectionism because they all go to Walmart and they don't have any money and they get cheap stuff. I agree with that. And I agree that it makes farming and people more competitive in a free market. I understand all that. And so I don't want to be a protectionist. But there, whether we like it or not, whether it's devaluation of currency or EU subsidies or the strange EU practice of and Japanese practice of subsidizing their own products and not allowing agricultural products to go in or to depending on us for defense. These are things that have been ongoing and they've been a problem. So you get this guy who's crude in a buffoonish Manhattan real estate and he starts waving his hand and saying this and this. And I think they're going to, the Canadians and the Mexicans have already said, you know what, we're willing to renegotiate some things on the trade deal with NAFTA. And the Chinese would say, don't do this, don't do this, but they will renegotiate. And I think the same thing will be true of NATO. And the same thing is true of immigration. He said a bunch of really callous, crude things that we're going to send all the Muslims back. And I think what he was saying is there's certain areas in the world, Syria for one, Libya for another, where we're not just going to let, as Obama did, people come in. But to get attention, to be crazy, to calm him down, to get sober and judicious voices to say, come on, Donald, move to the... That's what he does. And I think all of his positions in the campaign have reflected that. That he said something extreme, like I'm going to deport everybody and I can tell you, I've talked to people in that campaign. They're not going to deport people who were born as a child here, who have never broken the law, who were employed or in school. They're not going to deport them. But that wasn't what they said originally. But they brought that issue, and then everybody got upset and said, please don't do it. And he said, well, if you're not, maybe we won't deport them, but we want to deport the 2 million felons. How's that? That's what he does. And I'm not saying it's a good way to operate, but it's a reaction against both the Republican establishment and Barack Obama.
Victor, what does it do long-term? What does it do long-term to the political climate if we become accustomed to people saying extreme, outrageous things? And then,
like what? Can I give you an example?
Like thousands of Muslims celebrated 9/11 in the streets. How about that?
Yeah, well, punish our enemies at the polls if you're Latinos, get in their face. Mm-hmm. That was pretty bad. Bring a gun to a knife fight. That was pretty bad. You didn't build that. That's pretty bad. It's not
for
profit. That was pretty bad. You made enough money.
Those are all bad things. And we said
they all survived that. But the whole media is not paranoid about what he said. That's the point. They just pitched and rolled with it. And I'm not saying that it's good, but we've got to a situation where things, a lot of people feel that they're tired of the establishment. And so he was created by circumstances. Donald Trump wouldn't have won this election 10 years, 12, 15 years ago. It was the Republican establishment and Barack Obama in particular that created the environment that fostered. If we didn't have Donald Trump, you'd have to invent him. And that's where we are. And he offers solutions, but it's hard to find those solutions. I think all of you would realize, you know, in your privacy of your own emotions, your intellect, you would say, I'd rather have Jeff Sessions than Loretta Lynch. I'd rather have Mattis than Ash Carter. I would probably rather have the people at EPA or the people at Homeland Security than the Obama people. I mean, the cabinet looks pretty good to me. I've looked at the proposed tax code, the deregulation. I've looked at Keystone. I've looked at exporting coal from Wyoming and Appalachia, liquefying natural gas, building three, helping the federal government build three reservoirs, which we're letting 11 million acre feet out because we don't have storage during the storm in California. I mean, they're all preferable. And that's what politics is. It's 51% versus 49. It's not purity. It's not perfection. We never get that. And we say we do sometimes, but we don't. And
so, Victor, Peter here.
For me, it's whether you like your crudity cooked or you like it raw. I thought Obama was pretty crude. He's very crude, I thought, in what he said, what he did. If Donald Trump brought a rapper to the White House whose cover, To Pimp a Butterfly, had a white dead judge with a bullet hole in his head and X's crossed out in his eyes, and then black rappers toasting his demise, and that person went to the White House and Trump said, this is my favorite singer, you would see outrage, and we'd never see anything like that we would hear. But we've gone so accustomed to it that the antidote to it, the medicine, is worse than the disease.
It's not the antidote, though. It's more of the same medicine. It's not an antidote. That's the problem.
I don't mean the antidote that it's the proper medicine, but it's the reaction to it. And Trump hasn't done that yet. He has not. He's not going to bring a country western singer to the White House who has an album analogous to that. I doubt that you'll have a country western singer come to the White House and his probation bracelet will go off on his ankle. I really don't see that. Or, you know, he tweets, but I haven't seen him, you know, be interviewed by somebody like Glozell. And then the closest people say is Steve Bannon. I've known Steve Bannon for 20 years. He's a lot of things, but one thing he isn't is anti-Semitic. He's the most fervent supporter of Israel I've ever met. He's fanatic about it. And this idea of moving the embassy and the selection on that was all Steve Bannon. So I don't really trust the traditional criticism of Trump until we see it. And you know what? I agree, but I won't. I know this has been I wasn't for him until the other candidates were eliminated. Then I thought that he would be far preferable to Hillary Clinton.
Right.
But I'll tell you one thing that I think I'm really worried about, and it's really changed me at my late age, is that I talked to a very prominent conservative. I won't mention his name out of deference. And he said to me face to face, there's three possibilities in this election, and only one is good. Donald Trump wins, it's a disaster. Hillary Clinton wins by 2 points, and we get blamed. Donald Trump loses in a landslide, and we're redeemed, and that's what we want, and that's why I keep saying that he's a danger. And I said, well, why would you want that? Because then we'll have a catharsis. We'll get rid of this know-nothingism out of the party. We'll rebuild it with sober and judicious people. And I said, in the process, you will lose the Supreme Court for a generation.
Right.
You will have appointees, and you'll have 16 years of Obamaism, and you'll destroy the lives of thousands and millions of people. And he didn't care. And he said, you know what he said to me when he left? Tell your friends, I don't have any friends in the Trump, but he lives in Washington, I live out in the country, I see nobody with power. And he said, tell your friends that if they need wise counsel, if this renegade should win, I'm here to be consulted. And I just read something by Max Boot, Elliot Cohen. What are they saying? Well, yes, I said some critical things, but they should consult us. No, you didn't, Max. You didn't say critical things. You said he was like Stalin, worse than Stalin. Hitler, brown shirts. So when you say all that, and then you sit there in Washington, you're smug, and you think this guy is going to call you up and say, I'm just a naive, I'm bombastic, I'm a demagogue, but you guys are really brilliant people. I know you said I was Hitler, but would you please help me out of my ignorance? And what kind of mindset is that? And what are the conditions that create that sense of self? And that's where we are right now. And I tell you, I'm a rock solid conservative, but after the last 6 months, reading my email, I know everybody said, well, they get hate email from Trumpsters, but I am sick and tired of the Republican elite establishment. Almost everything I read, it's like a cough or it's a Philip or something. They cannot write analysis without saying the following. Of course, you know, he's a buffoon. Of course, you know, he's a cretin. Of course, you know, he's psycho. And that's almost like David Victor, Gruber. And that's not Victor, helpful. It's destroying the entire conservative movement.
So as far as my perception is, from where I sit, you know what I see? I see nothing but conservatives who have decided that Trump is just fine, that all of this concern about the many, many things that he has said and done that are unfit or disturbing or worrying, we've forgotten about all that, get on the Trump train or get run over, you're so history, no one cares about you anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So we can all go through our mail and cite, and furthermore, you know, the comments of leading conservatives and suggest that somehow it's all on one side or the other. I think it very much depends on where you sit. I've seen very, very, very many conservatives.
I don't think that's the view of the flagship conservative establishment as embolized by Commentary, National Review, Weekly Standard, much of the Wall Street Journal, the think tanks, AEI, Uber. That's not the consensus.
Mona just used an interesting word. She said something was or wasn't helpful. So here's the question. I'm not quite sure. Well, Mona and Jay can answer this question themselves. I am certainly with you in that Donald Trump is a huge relief by comparison with what I feel certain we would have gotten with Hillary Clinton. Okay, I'm with you there. But I'm also with you in you see very clearly shortcomings on Trump. If he pushes protectionism too hard, too disruptive, overreaches on immigration, what is the helpful stance? I mean, genuinely helpful to the nation. He is the president. What is the helpful stance for conservatives to take? I think back, maybe this is, in fact, it's only if it's useful at all, it's only dimly useful. But I think back to National Review during the Nixon years, and National Review was pretty, as I recall, I was very young at that stage, but as I recall, Bill Buckley and National Review was the only outlet at that point. They were really quite straightforward. When Nixon was right, they cheered for him and gave their reasoning. And when he was wrong, they were straightforward and popped him. And again, gave their reasoning.
Can I just add to Peter's point really quick? I also have a very strong recollection during the Reagan years, the sainted Reagan, when George Will wrote a column saying it looks like this administration loves commerce more than it loathes communism, when there was a trade deal or something that the administration had completed with Soviet Union. So that
and,
there's
and
a
Bill
very
himself attacked
tradition.
Reagan in the second term
and
moving too fast.
And both of you and
Gorbachev. Sorry,
and George Will didn't say that. And George Will didn't say that Reagan was a cretin, did he? Or that he was analogous to the sons of Saddam Hussein? Or he didn't say that he was a Nazi? Or he didn't say he was analogous to Stalin? That's the level of invective we've had. And I could name the names who've said that. So that's what I'm – I agree with you. I think the proper stance for a conservative that's writing today is to have guarded optimism. And when Trump violates or he says – rather does things rather than says, because he'll say anything at any time to anyone. But when he violates conservative principles that you think are harmful, then you have a duty to criticize him. I criticized a lot. But the same token, as a general rule, I don't write anything that could be published in Slate or Salon. I just don't do it because I would rather go to them and do it. So if I'm writing for a conservative venue – I don't think that it's my duty to offer a conservative slant in my critique of it, but I don't use invective and adjectives that could be found in Rolling Stone or Mother Jones. And yet, when I looked at this thing, I might as well read them if I want to get a critique at that level. And that was pretty bad stuff. So whatever he did, and I understand that. I understand he's a flawed person. He bothers a lot me in a lot of ways, but there was an element that has never been discussed, it's never been explored, why he set certain people off in an emotional way. Was it class? I don't know what it was, but it was something that did not set other people off who shared the same reservations about it and led to a level of invective we haven't seen.
I think it was proud intellectual incuriosity. I think it was a boastfulness about what he didn't know, blanket statements that it wasn't important for him to know that, and a personality that needlessly demeaned and seemed to take joy in the demeaning of others. I'm just telling you.
Thank you, James. Well said.
That same objective, but people said the same thing about him. I mean, they said the same.
Well,
No,
you've been on the Hugh Hewitt show, and you know that Hugh treated Trump with nothing but respect, and Trump just simply kicked him in the groin for joy whenever he could and humiliated him during the debates because it's what he does. And you can say it's the New Yorker personality, but you can't – I mean, you can point to all of those things that Barack Obama said which were revolting, and they were said in a cool professorial tone, and the left agreed with a lot of them. So, no, of course, they didn't get the attention. But what we had, you can't say then that Trump isn't different because the whole thing about him is that his personality is
different. There's no doubt
about
it.
Difference means a level of invective, a level of statement, a level of discourse. And I know it is pointless at this point to argue about this, and it seems like an indulgence to talk about this. But when the president of the United States can just casually say that George Bush lied about 9/11 and other such things, we have reached a different level. And it's a done deal. And I'm not arguing it. It's fine. It's all baked in the cake.
No, I criticize him for that,
I'm telling you that's what it is.
The Iraq War.
I'm telling you, that's what it is for a lot of people. It's a different level.
Yeah, but I didn't say – I said to Trump, he's not telling the truth. He's lying about his initial opposition to the Iraq War. But I didn't say that he was a cretin for doing that. That's what politicians do. They all lie, I think. And so I try to – I never reached a level of opposition that could be printed in Salon or in this NBC's website. I never did.
Well, last question is
could I – I'm sorry, but Mona, it almost seems as though – I'm not sure that I'm right about this, but I'd like to ask both Mona and Jay, of course, if Jay wants to come in, but for sure Mona and Victor because I've been listening to the two of them just now. It almost seems as though Mona and Victor, you're not all that far apart in – this goes back to what is helpful. How should we conservatives conduct ourselves during these 4 years? That's the underlying question for me here this day. And Mona's view is he's such a stinker, really such a vile man in so many ways that the burden of proof lies on Donald Trump. He has to prove when he does something right. And with Victor, it's the other way around. I'm going to grant goodwill. I'm going to grant the burden of proof doesn't rest with Donald Trump. Is that, am I being totally unfair to you, Mona?
No, it's just that that's not at all the gravamen of my position, which is not, well, this is a rotten stinker and accordingly X, Y, or Z. My position is that this, that his views are anathema to good government, because what he believes most sincerely, I leave aside all the bad things that he said about people. I detest the way he treats people, his lack of civility, his inclination to attack, especially, it's been said many times, but even to attack someone for a handicap, he's got a vicious streak that I detest. But I would, you know, I can hear Richter already saying Obama could be that way too. Yes, and I didn't like it in Obama either, but I don't think it was quite in the same way. But whatever, leave that aside. The fact is, my point about Trump is, what worries me most about Trump is what I think he genuinely believes. And it's basically a Democratic position. It used to be the Democratic talking point that if we are not doing well, it's because commerce and trade are a zero sum game. If somebody's successful, it's because somebody else isn't. And we have to just flip it and make them unsuccessful and ourselves successful. And that's going to be the solution, which is not true. And it's a delusion and a snare. And because he has this pronounced idea that big government, just like the progressives, is going to fix it. He made promises today that, you know, were a little different in quality from the ones that Obama made. Obama said he was going to stop the rise of the oceans, and Trump said he's going to stop crime in the cities and the urban decay, and he's going to stop, he's going to eliminate ISIS, not a radical Islamic terror from the face of the earth, etc. So that is what I am protesting. That is what gets my back up. That is what makes every conservative instinct in my brain on fire.
To summarize, I really think your position is more modest than I at first thought it was. And modest may be the wrong word, but here's, you made three points. He has a mean streak. Granted, he'd better, and we should slap that down and object to it because we stand for civility. He's wrong on trade. Granted, he is wrong on trade, unless in practice what it means is he wants some adjustment. He wants to help the Central Valley. He wants to help certain sectors that are particularly exposed to trade. I don't know about, but certainly in principle, he said things over and over and over again that show he's just wrong on trade. That's item two of three. And the third is that he doesn't understand the dangers of big government. He has a tendency to think what struck me was the infrastructure promising. We'll build railroads. Right. I mean, it was everything down to Tinker Toys, for goodness
Tunnels,
sake.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, there again, I even on that one, I have something of an open mind, because Larry Kudlow said, no, you'd understand much of that infrastructure spending will be under, we're going to get out of the way of private industry. So Keystone Pipeline, it's not going to be a federal project, but that'll count toward infrastructure. But so I grant all three of those, but those are relative. He's wrong on trade. He has a mean streak. And in certain regards, he has too much. He doesn't know the dangers of dealing with the government. He's in favor of big government as long as it's pursuing purposes. You know what? By comparison with Hillary Clinton, my view is we can live with that. And those are three points on which we should always be alert. But it doesn't drive me into gnashing my teeth, I have to say.
And I think his cabinet members, Jim Mattis, is not in tune with Trump on a lot of things. A lot of his cabinet members, or Jeff Sessions, is not on something. And politics is 51-49. I keep saying that, but given the totality of worries compared to Hillary Clinton and the perpetuation of likely eight more years of Obamaism, it's not even a question. I mean, it speaks for itself. And as far as the mainstream, it bothers me terribly. And he's a narcissist, he's an egomaniac. But we live in a country where an iconic president like FDR came back in 1944 in the election and said, we didn't fight Nazism abroad to institutionalize it under Republicans here at home. And then he went to the New York Times and said, if you object to my court packing scheme again, I'm going to institute a special inheritance tax that's going to take it away from your family, Schultzberg. So, I mean, I think the media has conditioned us in a particular way that because of Trump's uncouthness, his crudity, his lack of precision in language, he's a caricature of a buffoon. I agree with that. But if you actually look at what he's done, I don't see that it's in any way atypical of what we've seen by other presidents or presidential candidates. I really haven't. He's just crude. And his speech, I thought that it was a rough around the range. It's very nationalistic. But you know what? It's just a raw version of what other people have said in much calmer and sober and judicious tone. It is. And 51% of his positions are, I think, much preferable to Hillary's. And that's enough for me. Because I voted for George Bush on the idea that he was going to balance the budget and he was going to control federal spending and he might eliminate a cabinet position or one or other and he would stop the occupation and insurrection in Iraq and he was going to be not euphemistic and therapeutic on radical Islam. And suddenly I found out that deficits didn't matter. We added another cabinet seat to the government. And yet I'm proud of my vote for George W. Bush. He's a wonderful person. But he did things on immigration that destroyed my community. I can tell you that open border stuff came in. The schools were overrun. In 8 years, we had 2 million illegal aliens in California. And whenever you objected, people in the Bush administration who came to Hoover, Jeb Bush, Clint Bullock, I went to their lectures. They basically said anybody who disagrees with open borders is a racist and a xenophobe. And then they went back to enclaves where their kids were in private school and everything was hunky-dory. So, but I'm happy with George W. Bush, and I defended him tooth and nail. But it was about 60% of the things that I was happy with. But that was so much better than the alternative to him with Al Gore. And I just didn't see why people who have done that traditionally in the Republican Party wouldn't do it after their favorite candidate. Mine was Walker, and then it was Rubio. And when they lost, I thought, you know what? I'll back somebody who's 51, 55% preferable to the alternative.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Victor. I think we're all on the same page now, and we can move forward now into this administration with unified arms linked as we cross the bridge. We'll probably have you on in a couple of months and have the exact same argument, but it's fun to have, and we always appreciate having you on the show. We'll see you around.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bye.
I wish that Victor could be appointed to the administration in some capacity, if only to see the Washington Post say, fiercely anti-classicist Victor Davis Hanson appointed to some humanities role or something like that. As they said of David Gelertner, who is a fiercely anti-intellectual, a man who is pretty much the definition of the modern intellectual, and the Washington Post calls him anti-intellectual, computer science.
Now, speaking of hiring... I would like to talk a little bit about hiring.
Wonderful.
It's the
Nicely
new year.
Done. Nicely done.
Well, yes, you just slapped the gear shift out of my hand as I was attempting to shift, Mona.
I was inspired by James to get to my segue.
And sniff that one coming. Go on.
It's the new year, which means a fresh start for your business. And a great year starts with making great hires. But posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter, you can jumpstart your hiring in 2017. Post your job to 200 plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 1 million businesses. And right now, my listeners, our listeners, can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial to try their service for free. One more time, ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. And we thank them for sponsoring this special joint Ricochet and Need to Know podcast.
Indeed. Thank you, Mona. You know, here's something to think about as we go forward as to how people who were opposed to Trump are going to deal with the years coming and continue to have an impact, because we were told during the election, after all, that the people who were the conservative ones were going to hold him to the fire and make sure that he did things in accordance with the GOP fundamental principles. I was never one of those people who was besotted with Barack Obama, his great, cool professorial stance, his soaring rhetoric. I don't think it's particularly great rhetoric, never was. Read it on the page and it's rather banal. Mm-hmm. But there were time to time that I had to tell myself, don't let your disinterest in the man color what your feelings about his policy. In other words, it's kind of stupid if you automatically gainsay anything he does because you just don't like the guy. And conservatives, a lot of them, find themselves in the same position now. They deeply do not like this guy for a variety of reasons. And is that going to be a problem for a lot of people on the right and makes it hard for them to grudgingly say when things are going okay? In other words, is having Trump that they don't like, is that a price they're willing to pay if good things get done? And Jay, I'll ask you.
I think the problem goes the other way for conservatives. I think conservatives fear to criticize Trump because of what people will say, because of the audience, because of donors, because of access and all that stuff. I know that a lot of conservatives hold back on what they really think about Trump because I don't want to upset right world. And people are kind of groping their way along. I think what a lot of people on my side will do is concentrate their fire on the left, and especially silly and excessive criticism of Trump from the left, because that's safe. That way you can stay on the happy side of the right, where it's more problematic, it's more of a risk to talk about Trump and Trumpism. So I think, you know, I don't really speak for anybody but myself, and sometimes I'm not so sure of myself, but I'll report the best I can and think the best I can and opine the best I can, and it comes out the way it comes out. I guess I think of myself as on a team, vaguely speaking, but one of the reasons I was drawn to conservatism is that I like the idea that we are individuals who will lie on certain things. And sometimes, as we have seen, alliances shift. And if a person who has long been a Republican or a conservative has critical things to say about Trump, he shouldn't be regarded as a traitor or a heretic, even if some of his words might be publishable by, you know, let's say Slate. So I just think, I don't know, I'm for a little more individualism and a little less groupthink and a little less heretic hunting. There are many, many, many reasons I dislike Trump and regret his election. Some of them have to do with him and his character. Some of them have to do with his worldview. But I think my main problem, frankly, is, and this will be an incendiary statement for many, I think even today, in January 2017, basically what I thought in 2015, and that is not pardonable by many on the right, I have discovered.
Wait. So what? I'm sorry. You think today? In other words, your opinion of Trump hasn't changed. I just want to clear
no,
up.
My opinions generally. In other words, I think the same things basically now that I thought in 2015 before the rise of Trump.
I see.
And that is seen by a great many on the right as disloyal, wrong, cuck, globalist, establishment, elite, blah blah blah. Names of people like me have been called every hour of every day for about a year and a half.
I have a friend who called the people who were never Trumpers guilty of treason. And I looked at that tweet and I just wondered how exactly we're going to sit down and have a conversation again.
I was recalled a refusenik the other day. I rather like that because I admire the refuseniks very much.
That's a term of honor, exactly.
That'll do, but treason twins the fate of Trump with the fate of the nation. It twins fealty with the fate of the nation. And that's the sort of thing that.
Yeah. Cult of personality much. Yeah.
And then, I mean, then this guy's a big major league old line conservative. I mean, you know him. Anyway, yeah. Mona, Peter, same question going forward. What's the right attitude to take?
Oh, I've talked myself into thinking of it so much that I may go back and pull up some national reviews from the Nixon years because I think Jay and I probably have different views on certain aspects of Donald Trump. But I subscribe to every word Jay just said. If we can't write what we believe, respond cleanly and honestly to Donald Trump, that is to say, it's the job of any journalist who's going to prove of any use at all to retain independent judgment. So I although I think Jay and I probably disagree on Trump, maybe less. Well, in any event, let's just we've already disagreed on the speech this morning, but I subscribe to every word Jay just said. You have to, in some sense, we're umpires. You have to call them as you see them. And if you start second-guessing your calls, I mean, because of pressures from any direction, you're useless. As a journalist, you're just done.
When I was forming my opinions and thinking about a career, I was so used to being in a minority and having to defend myself and being considered outrageous. I mean, I was at Columbia University as an undergraduate, and I was one of maybe three people in the entire undergraduate class, or so it seemed and felt, and certainly of the faculty, there were very few, who was conservative. And so I just took that as the natural course of life, that I was always going to be in the minority, and I was going to have to defend my views. But as things have developed over the last 18 months, you know, it's mostly slings and arrows that I've been getting from my own side. They're very disappointed in me. They're very angry that I've been critical of Trump. And I haven't changed. I mean, I still call it exactly the way I see it, and, you know, without fear or favor. And in fact, I did remember one day saying to Jay on our podcast, I said, I had a really unusual experience the other day on Twitter. I had a fight with a leftist. And it was almost nostalgia.
Such a relief. Such a relief.
So
those were the days. We what was the fight about? I'm curious.
Oh, gosh, now I don't remember. This was a while back. but it was with somebody. I think it might have been with somebody who wrote for the New Republic. Jeet Heer, I think
Jeet
is his
Heer.
Name.
And, yes. A man with not yes. with just plenty of vowels in his name. The vowels, yes. Equal number of vowels and consonants. And, well,
sorry, Jim. There's something I've discovered. You know, we on the right are always taunting the left about safe spaces and being triggered and all that, and oh, retreat to your safe space and your puppy dogs and your Play-Doh and all that stuff. But I have found that many on the right are like that, that they can't stand any word against the Trump they admire. They get the heebie-jeebies, they feel triggered, they need a safe space. I don't know if the right is entitled to taunt the left about this. I see a great intolerance of criticism of Trump on the right, and it's it hasn't been very fun. Frankly, hadn't been fun at all.
No,
Peter was outlining, you know, our objections to Trump or Mona's.
Mm-hmm.
They go a lot further than that. Of course, there aren't enough hours in the day, but I have problems having to do with character and having to do with issues. But mainly, I hope that he proves stable. I mean, in his person, in his mind, and in his character. I don't think there's a liberal or a democratic bone in his body. And I mean those in the very small L, small D sense. I think he's an authoritarian all the way and a self-lover. And he says things that we have always been taught to beware of. I'm the only one who can fix it. Just me. I will make every dream you've ever dreamed come true. All that stuff we on the right were taught to beware of. And now all of a sudden it's, yeah, MAGA, lock her up. Go team, America first. Even America first. When I was growing up, I was taught by conservatives and others that it was a smelly phrase. And here it is, the slogan of the American right and front and center in the presidential inaugural address. I think, as Charles Morris said in the column the other day, everything is front to back. Or as I'd say in my American way, many, many things are upside down. So it's only natural that people like me are feeling homeless.
Oh, okay. I feel the... This just having said 2 seconds ago, I agree with every word Jay says. I'm now back. I understand. It just seems to me that Donald Trump, more than most politicians and more than any president, who knows what he stands for? I mean, so you have to keep looking for what has he said today? This is all developing.
He's very consistent in his admiration of strongmen. Very consistent, making excuses for Putin. For example, it's pointed out to Trump that Putin sometimes kills people who disagree with him, political opponents like Boris right. Nemtsov.
Right.
And Trump's response is, well, I think this country does plenty of killing too. And that's the sort of thing we used to condemn as a grotesque moral equivalence.
Right.
But
right.
now it's, quote, our guy, not my guy.
Right, right.
But that was so long ago, Jay. That was –
the narcissism, he just gave
– during the campaign.
He just gave an inaugural address today in which he referred to himself. I don't think he used the word I once. He talked about the – that had to have been a conscious decision on the part of the speechwriter and Trump. He's going to – so –
After a fellow uses I-47 times in an hour, it's a nice thing. But it doesn't. I think there's the fact that he doesn't say I. I think the I is behind just about everything that he does say, that he regards himself with great admiration. But Jay, when I said that was back in the campaign, all that stuff is irrelevant. The past is irrelevant. Everything, and that's the part that bothers me about this too, is that we've assumed that other part of the left, that history all of a sudden began this morning, and everything that went before is of no use before. Hey, right, the etch-a-sketch is upended daily, and nothing, the accumulated wisdom that we have, matters anymore, because that was then and this is now, and things are different. Some things aren't different. There are rules. There are things that bind human civilization. They are things that guide us. Some of them you have to break. I agree. Sometimes you have to look at them and say, there's no reason you should pay that much money for a razor blade. And they're right. And they find a way to break the paradigm and bust decades, if not centuries, of accumulated wisdom. Used to be, of course, you'd have to go to King Gillette. Do we subscribe to kings? No, we are not of that sort. We are men. We are free men and women, and therefore that's why Harry's is the blade for us. Now, we've been telling you about this for a while, but in case you just got out of a cave and you're wondering what the hell is going on, it's like this. You know that for decades, the big razor companies, you know, big razor, they have relentlessly increased their prices and reaped immense profits. We like profits, but it's at your expense, frankly. Let's be honest there. So Jeff and Andy, a couple of ordinary guys fed up with getting ripped off, started Harry's to fix this shaving thing we got going on. And what they did, they bought the factory where everybody, that's right, Germany, and they offered the blades at half the price because the middleman has been eliminated. $2 a blade compared to $4 or more you pay at the drugstore. And the great thing is when they upgrade their blades and they upgrade their handles and their sauces and all that stuff, yes, you know, face sauce is what you put on before you shave. They don't charge you more money for it. So Harry's gives you everything you need for a close, comfortable shave with this kit. A weighted ergonomic handle. There's no falling out of your hand in the shower. 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip. Trimmer blade. Rich lathering shave gel. Or face sauce, as I like to call it, and a black blade travel cover. They're so confident in the quality of this, they want you to try it for free. That's right. You heard that word correctly. Just cover the shipping when you sign up. And plus is a special offer to all of you fans of the show. If you go to harrys.com right now and enter the coupon code, that's right, Ricochet, you'll get a post-shave balm also free. That's harrys.com, code Ricochet. Well, now we finish up here. Jay, we had a death in the relative of the strongman sphere today. And if there's anybody who's a go-to guy to tell us about the relatives of strongmen, it would be you. The world lost a Stalin, I believe.
Yes. Well, he was a Djugashvili. That was Stalin's original name, his Georgian name, and this was his firstborn, not the recently deceased. Sorry, but the father of the recently deceased. Stalin's first son, Yakov, was born in Georgia, and Stalin never gave this boy, Yakov, the glory of Stalin's adopted name, Stalin, Man of Steel. Yakov always had to remain a Djugashvili. The other two kids, the official kids, they were unofficial kids, they got the glory of the name Stalin, and they grew up in Moscow, in the Kremlin. But this boy, this man, Yakov, had a couple of kids, including a son named Yevgeny, who died last month. And he was a great Stalinist, a great, great booster of Stalin and rehabilitator of Stalin and worshiper of Stalin's memory and keeper of that flame. And he sued a lot of people for defaming Stalin. And I think the way I put it in a kind of obit was he was so litigious, he might as well have been an American.
How is it possible to defame Joseph Stalin?
Well, for example, you say that Excellent he was question. Responsible for the Katyn massacre.
And, imagine that.
And that's what right. the Duma, that's what the Russian legislature, the lower house, did back before the rise and the cementing of Putin's right. power. And so he sued the very Duma. So that's the kind of thing that bothered him. And some people questioned his paternity, and his maternity was unknown to the world at large. And it's still unknown to me, although biographers have guessed. But I don't question Yevgeny's paternity because it was written all over his face. He didn't have to cultivate that Stalin mustache. But even without the mustache, he would have looked a lot like the old man, which is to say the grandfather.
Well, I suppose the silver lining is that he was complaining. He was objecting to Stalin being held responsible for the Katyn massacre. I suppose if he had been a better Stalinist, he would have proudly taken credit for it.
Maybe he did that on a different day.
Maybe.
But Stalin is more popular in Russia at large than I think people like to think.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
This has been borne out in a few ways.
Right.
Well, Mona, and by the way, I did the exercise of reading every word, the transcript of Vladimir Putin's year-end press conference, which ran to about 4 hours, the press conference, and I read every word.
Wow.
And he ducked no question. I mean, sometimes he answered the questions in a politician-like way, but he answered every question except one. On the death of Yevgeny Dzhugashvili and efforts to rehabilitate Stalin. He skirted that entirely. And I bet it wasn't a thoughtless omission. Putin is a very, very canny guy.
Interesting.
Mona, last question for you. I just sighed there because
that was quite a sigh.
Well, there was a moment there. There was that little aperture in history where Russia seemed to be something that it was not going to revert to form. But of course, we ought to know better, and here we are. Mona, let's look at the speech, and which John Podhoretz called not dark and catastrophic, as some have said, but he said it was ridiculously utopian. He laid out a series of things that you can't possibly live up to. Well, that's what the speeches are for. And frankly, I wasn't looking at it for great rhetoric, and I didn't get it. You can say a lot of things about going to space and curing disease and all that, and that's all well, good and fine. And he said he will never disappoint us. He will never. Well, actually, what he said, not us, you. Which, again, everybody can take however they wish. It's not possible to become president and not disappoint vast swaths of people. And sometimes you have to. But I'm going to ask you to look at that speech and find something in it that you heard and that you liked. Ha!
Wow.
Another song.
Well, no. Look, I mean, there are aspects of his patriotic appeal, although I have my doubts about the patriotic appeal because I think it edges over into a nationalist kind of thing. So that makes me uncomfortable. I liked that he began the speech by saying that he wanted to rebuild our country and restore its promise for all the people. I think if there had been more like that, it would have been a better speech because certainly we have – one of the things that should be concerning, I think, for all of us is just how bitterly divided we are, and that's not healthy for the polity. It's a very sad state of affairs. I hold Obama responsible for some of it, but not all of it. And I think it would have been nice to hear a little bit more uniting rhetoric. But there was some, so I'll say I appreciated that small piece of it.
Peter, I'll leave you with this. Do you think that the left's is going to be able to restrain themselves and be focused, intense, sensible critics, the loyal opposition? Or do you think we're going to see 4 years of these people behaving like a Coke can that's just been put in a paint shaker for 45 minutes?
James, ask me a harder question than that. Of course, the latter. They weren't my wife, who has a subversive streak. We watched quite a lot of Fox, of course, but then she said, oh, let's just see. So she clicked over to CNN, and the tone was they really could hardly – well, I only watched it for about 10 minutes, but what was striking was they could hardly bring themselves to talk about Donald Trump. They talked again and again and again about what a sad day this was for the Obama – they were talking about Obama. Even as he had ceased to be president, they still felt he was their guy, that he was comfortable talking about him. This is going to be very hard for the press. Here's here's sort of my closing thought. Here's one thing I like, two things that I liked about where we stand. One, my favorite part of the speech was that it was not being delivered by Hillary Clinton. And two, you know, I sort of like the polls, the recent polls that show that although Donald Trump won the election, his approval ratings are remarkably low, because I think I understand that. I'm with Victor. This is a 49-51%. I reluctantly voted for Donald Trump. I wish him well. I understand all the objections. In other words, I want him to succeed and I voted for him. But what I don't know quite what I'd say if a pollster asked me for, do I approve of Donald Trump? Well, no, not really. I just hope he succeeds as president of the United States. So I actually like the idea that by comparison with, I know for sure there's a, my judgment is this cult of personality with Donald Trump that is much narrower. 8 years ago, you will recall the cult of personality that centered on Barack Obama involved both houses of Congress, the entire press. It was overwhelming. And now my judgment is that the nation is fundamentally more mature about this man and about the presidency of the United States. They hope he gets more things right than wrong. If you're a conservative like me, you're very eager to see the economic package get moved through Congress in the next 100 days. You're very hopeful that Trump's first Supreme Court nominee, which the administration has promised within the next 2 weeks, is something closer to Antonin Scalia and Justice Thomas than to Stephen Breyer or Elena Kagan. But this guy is what he is, and we need to hope for the best. States, as conservatives, make it clear when we disagree with him, which we will a lot, and support. But we need to provide the intellectual undergirding for what's taking place, because he won't do it.
That we elected Popeye. Yam what he am. I said, we elected Popeye. Yam what he am.
I give him that, actually. I give him that. He is what he
is. You're right to go back to think of what it was like when Barack Obama ascended into the office or descended down to us mortals. And it was borne along by a great cloud of admiration and love from the press, because they saw themselves reflected in him and flattered by his existence. Now they see themselves repudiated by the president, and it's going to make them very, very angry, which means we are in for 4 years of reporting on the absolute miseries of America, which began anew today. Gird yourself. We're going to discover homelessness. We're going to discover the plight of various immigrant communities. It's the descent of America into teen dystopian fiction type scenarios begins now, and it's not going to be fun. But those of us out here in Ricochet Land will be cheerful, because that's what we are. What's your choice? Maybe we'll have Rob Long next time to tell us some jokes. Rob being the funny guy that he is. He had a good piece in Variety magazine, this Variety Weekly this week. Go read it. It's sort of advice to people in Hollywood as to how to deal with Trump, putting him in the context of actors and directors. It's actually quite wise and funny, as Rob usually is. And we thank, of course, Jay and Mona for coming by and conjoining their show with ours today. You can always listen to Need to Know at Ricochet as well. You can go to the Ricochet store and buy stuff. That'd be great. You could sign up for Ricochet. That'd be even better. And you could go to iTunes and give us a nice little review, because that helps other people find us. Hey, we want to thank the Great Courses Plus. We want to thank Harry's Shave and, of course, ZipRecruiter as well for sponsoring this, the Ricochet Podcast. Peter Robinson for being here. Blue Yeti as ever for making it all possible. And you, the Ricochet audience, and Slate Panoply listeners as well, for sticking with us as long as we have. Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week at Ricochet 3.0.
Fine. Ricochet. Join the conversation.